طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح، طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, where each week you will hear the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian perspective, the Palestinian voice exploring the realities of the Israeli occupation of the Palestinian homeland. You will not hear this narrative very often in the Western media, which is why it is so important that we present it each week on Truth and Justice Radio. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Pham and is continued in his memory. This is your host, John Roberts. Well, here they are at it again. The Massachusetts Jewish lobbies, with JCRC at the helm, are trying to again pass legislation that will attack the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement. Unsuccessful last term, the lobby is again trying with stealth anti-discrimination legislation that does not mention BDS or boycott, but would allow the targeting of the BDS movement. The bill, framed as an anti-discrimination bill, looks innocuous. It is not. An alert was sent out by the Alliance for Water Justice in Palestine to its supporters and members of a large coalition of organizations that have coalesced to counter the attacks on BDS. The alert reads in part, "Dear Alliance supporters, Massachusetts leaders are trying to take away our right to boycott again. State Senator Cream of Newton has filed SB 922, a bill that would penalize supporters of the Palestinian Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions BDS movement for justice, as well as other social movements that employ time-honored tactics of economic pressure. The House bill is submitted by Representative Paul McMurtry, is House Bill 779. It is the same bill. Call your senator and state representative immediately to ask that they oppose this dangerous bill. This isn't just about our state senate. This is not just a formality or an isolated attack. It is not even just about Palestine. This amendment is a piece of a coordinated right-wing attack on our right to organize for justice, period. As Trump and Republican lawmakers attempt to criminalize dissent in Washington, we will not allow free speech suppression in Massachusetts. With so many people taking to the streets right now fighting for justice, equity, and democracy, it is more important than ever to resist any and all attacks on our movements." Senator Cream's bill is framed as anti-discrimination legislation when in reality it forbids the state from contracting with institutions and individuals who boycott companies that profit off the Israeli occupation and policies of apartheid. If Senator Cream had introduced this bill in 1975, it would have made activism against South African apartheid substantially more difficult. Recall in July 2016 when Senator Cream tried to sneak an anti-boycott amendment into the Economic Development Bill. We happened to be doing our water information delivery to the legislators, and along with Massachusetts Peace Action and Jewish Voice for Peace, mobilized so quickly that she withdrew the amendment on the very same day. We can stop it again. We need you to call. Call your senator and state representative now and ask that they oppose the bill. Nearly 100 Massachusetts organizations have signed a statement opposing any legislation that impedes the right to boycott. That includes groups representing Muslims, Christians, Jews, American Indians, students, professors, labor unions, lawyers, and LGBTQ communities, as well as advocates on human rights, peace and justice, anti-racism, housing, criminal justice reform, corporate accountability, civil liberties, and climate change. We're part of a team led by Massachusetts Peace Action and Jewish Voice for Peace. Tell your senator, thousands of progressives throughout Massachusetts oppose this type of attack on our movement for Palestinian human rights. That was an excerpt from an alert sent out by the Alliance for Water Justice in Palestine to mobilize opposition to the newly filed anti-boycott bills in the Massachusetts legislature. Now, before the legislation gains traction, is the time to lobby your legislators. And now on to our feature presentation, which this week is part two of the interview with British journalist Jonathan Cook, who lives and writes from Nazareth, a predominantly Palestinian Arab city in the north of Israel. To hear part one, if you are so inclined, please find it in our archive, which you can access on the internet at truthandjusticeradio.org, all one word, truthandjusticeradio.org, and then click on This Week in Palestine Archives. This interview is about 10 years old and was done on the occasion of Jonathan Cook's publication of his book, Blood and Religion, The Unmasking of the Jewish and Democratic State. But it continues to resonate because he goes into great detail describing the plight of Palestinians who live in the State of Israel and constitute some 20% of Israel's citizens. We left off last week with his description of problems Palestinian Arabs have in finding professional work in Israel where they live. Although the Palestinian population is highly educated, finding work as a professional, a doctor, engineer, lawyer, or academic, is close to impossible. We pick up at the point where Jonathan Cook observes that much of the purpose of this is to make life difficult for Israeli Arabs, so that they will leave. That is where we pick up the interview this morning.
It's hard not to interpret some of these policies, certainly those Israeli policies imposed in the occupied territories and also those imposed on Palestinian Israelis, to interpret these policies as a deliberate effort to drive Palestinians out, to force them to see their future as professionals, as academics, as lawyers or doctors, to see their future outside of Israel,
exactly.
To leave the country, to go somewhere else, to go to Europe or go to the United States.
Well, I'll give you a good example. There's been a campaign here among the Palestinian citizens of Israel for many decades to create Israel's first Arab university, teaching in the Arabic language. It's never been allowed. Israel has always made sure that it wouldn't happen. Now, there are good reasons why it doesn't want an Arab university. It would help create this professional class, this leadership that would help organize Palestinians inside Israel, give them new vision, new understanding. What happens instead is that if you don't want to go to an Israeli university where you're going to have to be taught in Hebrew, which is your second language, and it immediately puts you at a disadvantage against Israeli Jewish pupils, who you're competing with, your options are to go to Jordan, for instance, and go to one of the universities there, which a lot of Palestinian students now do. They go to Jordan and they study at one of the universities in Amman. Now, once they finish that education, there's a good chance they meet somebody there, maybe a Jordanian, and maybe they think to get married. And there's a good chance that they won't come back. And that's exactly how Israel likes it. And you'll see that in all sorts of policies that are here, which encourage people to leave. One of the few political parties, dissenting non-Zionist political parties that were allowed inside Israel was the Communist Party. It was mainly because in its early days, the Jewish community was the organizers and leaders of the Communist Party inside Israel. So it was difficult to ban it. But one of the benefits for Israel in terms of its Palestinian community was that the Communist Party used to give grants to Palestinians to go and study. Most Palestinian intellectuals here could not get to an Israeli university. The restrictions were too severe. So if you wanted to get an education as a doctor, as a dentist, as a lawyer, some of the main trades that are allowed here, as I said, the service industries, what would typically happen is that you would apply, you would join the Communist Party here, and then apply for a scholarship. And you often people got scholarships. A number of people I know here who speak East European language. I mean, all sorts of languages, Moldovan, Hungarian, Russian. And that's because they studied and trained in the communist bloc, in the Soviet bloc. Now, many of them didn't come back. They married a Moldovan or Hungarian, and they stayed there. And again, Israel was quite happy with that arrangement and encouraged it. And it was one of the reasons it made it so difficult for, one, I mean, there are many reasons, but one of the reasons it made it so difficult for Palestinian citizens to get to Israeli universities, as is still the case. It's still extremely difficult for them to get to universities and still underrepresented there.
What are some of the other elements of the conflict that you address in your book?
I think the other really important issue, which we haven't mentioned so far, is and it's a key question for Israel, again, both sides of the Green Line, is the question of demography, the question of numbers, who has the larger number of people. And that's been a Zionist obsession, as we know, since before 1948. It was one of the driving forces for the whole program of ethnic cleansing that was carried out in 1948. Because Israel, to be a Jewish state, needs a very strong Jewish majority. Otherwise, it doesn't have the legitimacy. If it's kind of 50% Palestinians, 50% Jews, difficult to sell that idea of a Jewish state as a legitimate idea. So Israel has been working assiduously for many decades to ensure that demographically it's in control, that it has the higher numbers. Now, one of the questions that I look at in the book is this whole problem of the numbers game for Israel. One of the things that Ehud Olmert mentioned in November 2003 in an interview in Haaretz, shortly before Ariel Sharon announced the disengagement, in an interview he said, the biggest threat to us, I'm paraphrasing here, but the biggest threat to us would be if the Palestinians start a campaign, a struggle for one man, one vote, just as the blacks did in South Africa under apartheid, because this would look like a legitimate struggle. And that would be dangerous to us as a Jewish state. And it's not insignificant that a month later, Ariel Sharon mentioned for the first time at the Herzliya conference his idea for disengagement from Gaza, because the two ideas are intimately linked. The disengagement from Gaza, and this is one of the major arguments I make in the book, was entirely a demographic move. It was a way of buying time for the state, just as demographers inside Israel were warning that the numbers of Palestinians and Jews were reaching parity, that within ten years, there would be a similar number of Jews and Palestinians inside the greater Israel area. It was at that point that Sharon was sold on the idea of the disengagement. Gaza had never been particularly important to the Zionist dream. It had a large number of Palestinians, 1.4 million of them. By getting rid of them, severing them off from the greater Israel dream, he immediately bought Israel a couple of decades to sort out its other demographic problems, which was Palestinians inside Israel and also the Palestinians in the West Bank. So, and I think it's important to realize that the demographic threat is seen to be as much inside Israel, if not more inside Israel, than it is in the occupied territories. This is often overlooked. And Israel has been working very carefully over the last few years to manage the demographic problem inside Israel. And that's where we're seeing the new ideas, like the Lieberman ideas, about transferring the population from inside Israel into the occupied territories. And one of the major arguments I'm making in the book is that the disengagement and the idea of convergence, which has now been put on hold, but effectively it's happening anyway because the West Bank wall is still being built. I mean, that's the new line, political line Israel is creating. Well, what's the significance of that political line? And I think the significance of it is that Israel will create some kind of series of ghettos which it will then want the international community to call a Palestinian state. And it will then say, well, that is the place where the Palestinians have their right to recognition and to exercise their sovereign rights. That is a Palestinian state. If you want to be a Palestinian, go to that Palestinian state. And that's basically Lieberman's argument. His argument is, if you want to be a Palestinian and you're a citizen of Israel, well, then you have to renounce your citizenship and go and live in that Palestinian state. That's the whole concept of this transfer of the Little Triangle, this area that's very close to the West Bank, which he wants to be moved in on the other side of the wall, so it will become effectively part of this Palestinian state, this pseudo-Palestinian state that they're talking about. They're also talking about the idea that if you want to demand a state of all its citizens, which is seen as treasonous and subversive, that will become an illegitimate political platform inside Israel. It already, in fact, is an illegitimate platform. It's not possible as a political party to stand here and demand or to not acknowledge Israel as a Jewish and democratic state. It hasn't been enforced yet, but that is the law. So at some point we can assume that Israel will start enforcing that. But what people are talking about is loyalty oaths. And I think that's what's likely to for the rest of the Palestinian community inside Israel to face quite soon, will be these loyalty oaths. You will have to pledge allegiance to Israel as a Jewish and democratic state, which will negate any claims you might have to Israel being a state of all its citizens. That's the way you negate that threat. You say, well, if you want to live inside Israel and be a Palestinian, you have to acknowledge that Israel is a Jewish and democratic state, and you can't challenge that. And if you want to, then you have to go and live in this pseudo-Palestinian state we're creating next door. I think that's the game plan. How soon it'll be realized, how effectively, is difficult to say, but that's the vision that emerged. I think that's the Sharon vision, it's the Olmert vision, and I think it's also the army's vision, and that's what we're seeing being created at the moment, a series of ghettos which will be called a Palestinian state. They'll be behind a series of walls and fences, and if you want to be a Palestinian inside Israel, then you're going to have to say, okay, well, my Palestinian identity is just, it's just a kind of symbolic identity, it doesn't have any real meaning. And I pledge allegiance to Israel as a Jewish and democratic state, which, in other words, I have to pledge allegiance to a state which discriminates against me, which doesn't recognize me as an equal to a Jewish citizen. And that's going to put Palestinians inside Israel in a very difficult situation. They're going to be faced with a choice of either accepting their second or third class status inside Israel permanently, or leaving the state, going and living in a state which is, as we've seen in Gaza, even after the withdrawal of the settlers and of the army, it's no kind of life, it's no kind of statehood. It's a prison, a very large prison. And I don't think many Palestinian citizens of Israel are going to opt for that choice. So they're effectively going to have to buy into their second or third class citizenship. And I think that's a clever move by Israel, and it might well be bought by the international community.
I'd like to ask about countertrends.
Yeah.
The description of these Bantustans, the strategy being imposed on the West Bank, it's not something new. We have the recent history of South Africa as a precedent, as a guide to where this may lead. What do you see as the countertrends, the reservoirs of hope, that another direction might be possible for the people of the region?
Well, unfortunately, I'm not great on hope. I will do my best, though. I think one has to recognize that all regimes learn from their predecessors' mistakes, and I have no doubt there were very close ties between Israel and apartheid South Africa, and I have no doubt that Israel has learned the lessons from apartheid South Africa's failure, and it will not repeat them exactly. It will change the format and the implementation enough. It hopes that it can, that the international community will buy it, and that's really what matters, or Americans will buy it, the American regime will buy it, which is what really counts. So I think there's that first obstacle. I mean, that anybody who opposes what's going on faces is that Israel isn't going to be stupid and just replicate apartheid South Africa. It's going to do it more cleverly, and so we're going to have to be more clever in our arguments. The second thing is that we have an obstacle which the opponents of apartheid South Africa didn't have, which is that if we criticize Israel, we're called anti-Semites. That's a very powerful argument. It's a very powerful argument for most people. And it's a big problem. You know, if you opposed apartheid South Africa, what did people call you? You know, they didn't have a word for it. I mean, if you supported the rights of the black people of South Africa, in general, that was seen as a good thing. It helped also that America has a large black community population, and so you had support on your side if you were fighting for the rights of the black population of South Africa. Now, the problem in America is almost reversed, where you have a large, or not maybe such a large community, but you have a significant, influential Jewish community who, in the main, are quite supportive of Israel. Not on everything, but still fairly supportive. And so the power balance is rather different, I think, in this case. And it's much harder to argue your case. There aren't so many Palestinians inside America, and those that there are tend to keep their heads down rather than out there arguing vociferously for the rights of the Palestinians in the occupied territories. So I think we should be aware of those hurdles, those obstacles, and not suggest that it's going to be, the fight is as easy as it was in the case of apartheid South Africa. What hope is there? I think there's always the hope that that anyone arguing for and campaigning for universal rights and for justice, you know, you have right on your side. It's a powerful argument, and as long as it's heard, I think you can make a significant dent in, a significant impression on people. I mean, I think there is also maybe a third element to this, a third obstacle which I haven't mentioned also, which is the American media, which is not very supportive or very realistic about what's going on here, and is part of the problem as well, because it prevents ordinary Americans from really hearing what's going on. So that's another obstacle that has to be confronted. But as long as we can make ourselves heard, we can make people realize what the issues are and what's going on, there is the hope that message will be understood and will be powerful, because we're talking about universal rights here. We're talking about Palestinians having the same rights as Israeli Jews. So that's one small ray of hope. I think the other hope is that Israeli Jews are starting to realize that Palestinians, I mean, there's been a process for the Israeli Jewish population here. They've undergone a series of stages of recognition of the Palestinians, which may be difficult for us to imagine that they would have been able to, for instance, recognize the idea of a Palestinian state 20 or 30 years ago. People didn't talk in those terms. I mean, I have Israeli Jewish friends, who older ones, who remember a time when it was just not possible to talk about Palestinians ever having a state. Well, it is possible to talk about that now. I don't think it's very realistic. Most Israeli Jews' understanding of what might be needed to create a Palestinian state isn't very realistic yet, but at least they've made that kind of mental leap, and that's a first stage. I think the communities, the small groups I was talking about earlier, like Zohrot, and there are other ones, Tayush is another one, important one. These small groups are very active, they're very vociferous, and they're very committed, and they are slowly starting to make an impression. There was a lot of hostility, for instance, as I mentioned, to Zohrot when they first started their activities. But in general, I've noticed, and I know from Etin Bronstein, who's the director of Zohrot, that there's a large number of Jews who are at least curious about what they're doing. Maybe not approving of it, but curious. Not immediately hostile. When he first started doing these signposting projects in the destroyed villages, he was just met with hostility, and sometimes with physical violence. Now, more often, there's a curiosity. There's a sense of, who are you? What are you doing? Why are you doing it? And that's a change, and it's an important change, and it's the beginning of a process of understanding. It leads somewhere hopeful, and that's, to me, the small sign of hope that I cling to, that if Israeli Jews can start to want to know why somebody might want to put a signpost up with an Arabic name on it, that's the beginning. And it's a small one, but it's the beginning, and it could lead to something significant. So that's maybe the hope I can offer, but I appreciate it's not a huge one.
You've spoken a little about the United States, the main benefactor of the State of Israel. Could you talk about the United States' role in influencing the direction of events here?
Yeah, that's a difficult question. It's a particularly difficult question maybe for me to answer. I'm not American. I'm British. And I live in Israel and have been for the last 5 years. So I tend to see things from this end rather than... I read a lot about what's going on in America, but again, it's not my personal knowledge that I'm drawing on here. It's my impressions from reading the media. I think that we're in a state of flux right now. And I think Americans are in a state of flux about the whole Middle East. I mean, there are big questions being opened up. Really, Israel had a little comfortable monopoly on what was going on here in terms of our understanding. You know, Israeli soldiers were the ones that died in wars against the Arabs, and so it was difficult to question what Israel was doing, and they were the ones suffering, so who are we to tell them what to be doing? But that's not true anymore. I mean, there are lots of Americans, as we know, dying and being injured in Iraq, not so far away, and the question is, why are they there and what are they achieving, and is there a connection between that and Israel? Israel was one of the big cheerleaders of the invasion of Iraq. I mean, I was here at the time, and I remember how there was almost uniform support for the idea of invading Iraq. And we know that neoconservatives, who have a strong affinity with Israel, were also key movers behind the whole idea of invading Iraq. So I think that these kind of questions are starting to be raised for the first time in America. People are asking, what's Israel's role in the Middle East? What's it trying to achieve? And how does that relate to us in America and our involvement in the Middle East now? And as we've seen with this recent paper by Walton Mearsheimer, some significant people in American intellectual world, and I think we're starting to see the beginnings of people raising issues about what is American foreign policy in the Middle East doing? What's it trying to achieve, and who's pushing for what? So I think there are questions being raised. I mean, it's clear to me, even from here, I can see that Americans are... There is a movement there. People start to question what's going on and whether Israel is playing fair in the Middle East. You know, whether the connection... There is a connection, as we've also seen with this recent Hamilton Baker report as well. Question of how connected are the questions of what's happening to the Palestinians and wider issues and problems America's facing in the Middle East. Hostility. So I think that Israel hasn't got a monopoly on wisdom anymore. It isn't controlling the debate, and that's going to become harder and harder for it to do. The debate is going to start widening out, and other people are going to start having their voice heard. And that's only a healthy... I think that's only a healthy thing. How quickly it'll happen, I don't know, though.
Let's talk about the sort of issues that typically have a tremendous influence on how many people view the conflict here in Palestine-Israel. I wonder if we could talk about the Qassam rockets that are currently being fired from Gaza into Israeli communities near the border. Certainly when these issues are reported in the United States, they are typically placed within the context of Israel's struggle to provide security for its people.
Yeah. So,
just within the last week, and we're speaking on December 28th, two Israeli teenagers were very seriously injured by a Qassam rocket that struck the town of Sderot. How do you talk about these incidents and the violent resistance that is a part of the resistance against the Israeli occupation?
Sure. Well, I think there are two ways of looking at that issue. I mean, one, and I think it's an important one to remember, and one that tends to be ignored in the States, I think, is that actually the Palestinians do have a right under international law to resist the occupation, and they can resist it violently. We can then have a debate about what's sensible resistance or what's productive resistance and what's harming their cause. But that's largely a matter of perception often, and that's something that the Palestinians don't have a lot of control over. That's how their resistance is framed by, for instance, the international media and the American media. So, I want to make the first point that, of course, the Palestinians do have a right to resist the occupation, and it's important to remember that, not to forget it. But I think there is a valid question about how productive, how useful, how successful the armed resistance has been. That's a question that I think Palestinians have been having through the Intifada. They've been seriously considering how successful has an armed Intifada been. And I think we tend to assume that the lull in suicide attacks is a reflection of the building of the wall. I actually think that's a major mistake. I think it's actually a conscious decision by the Palestinians. What people possibly abroad don't realize is that the wall is far from finished, and there are major gaps in it, including in Jerusalem still, so that any suicide bomber who wants to get into Israel still pretty much can. I mean, if you're determined to get into Israel, and we can assume suicide bombers are pretty determined, they can get in. So the question is, why have there been such a drop in the number of attacks? And I think that's a conscious choice by many of the Palestinian factions to stop the suicide bombings. I think they realized they weren't being helpful to the Palestinian cause. And we tend to just assume it's because entry to Israel has been blocked. I think that's far too simplistic a view of what's been going on. So there is a debate within Palestinian society about what to do. But I think maybe the most important point, which is usually neglected, is that most of the time Palestinians are resisting in non-violent ways to the occupation, and it's almost entirely ignored. When they resist non-violently, nobody notices, which is one of the reasons I think that the Intifada turned so violent, was because Palestinians realized that unless they were violent, nobody really noticed. Nobody took note. The media didn't turn up. One of the most high-profile, but still not very high-profile, acts of resistance that has been happening every Friday for more than a year now has been in a small village called Bilin, where Israel is building a wall on Palestinian land, annexing farmland from that village and destroying any hope of the livelihoods of the people who live there. Now, there's been demonstrations, non-violent demonstrations there every Friday for more than a year, attended by local Palestinians, by international solidarity activists, and by Israelis, both Palestinian citizens and Israeli Jews. That's had virtually no coverage. There's very little coverage of that. And it's significant because those non-violent demonstrations have been greeted by the Israeli army with violence. What's been happened to those demonstrators is that they've regularly faced rubber bullets, some live ammunition. People have been shot, injured. They've been using experimental crowd control techniques, which has been covered by the Israeli media. I mean, the Israeli media have written quite extensively about this, but you very rarely see anything written in the international media or American media about this. So that's a high-profile example of non-violent resistance. But of course, there are small examples of that going on all the time. Just the struggle that Palestinians make every day to go to their schools or their universities or hospitals, these are forms of non-violent resistance, the occupation, because the occupation is all about stopping them doing these things. These 500-plus checkpoints that exist all over the West Bank are designed to stop Palestinians leading normal lives, to going to school or university or to hospital, or getting to the market to buy things or to sell produce. So just turning up at the checkpoint and refusing to be intimidated by it is a form of non-violent resistance. But of course, it gets no coverage whatsoever. So I think, in a way, the whole question of resistance has become a trap for the Palestinians. If they resist in non-violent ways, nobody notices, nobody cares, and Israel wins. And if they resist violently, then everybody condemns them and calls them savages and barbarians. So really they can't win on that argument. I think the whole question, which is why it brings us back to the question of what are their rights under international law? Well, their rights under international law are that they have the right to resist the occupation in any way they choose, which is violently or non-violently. Obviously they should be resisting insofar as they can, in ways that target military facilities, soldiers, and so on. But it's interesting, when they do that as well, they get condemned. When they captured a soldier who was at a military post just on the borders of Gaza, firing part of an artillery battery that was firing into into Gaza, and therefore an entirely legitimate military target. When they captured that soldier, Gilad Shalit, Gilad Shalit has become this kind of poster boy for those who kind of want to argue that that the Palestinians are not behaving in legitimate ways. It's being used by the politicians to justify the sanctions that have been imposed on the Palestinians. I mean, it's become a kind of contributing factor to an argument that was already being made against Hamas and its election. So I think all in these kind of ways that the Palestinians can't win, and I think that's the way the whole thing is set up, so they can't win. Israel and America have kind of engineered the debate, the argument, in such a way that whatever the Palestinians do, they're playing foul. And I think it's important that we highlight that all the time as well. There is no way that the Palestinians can behave which is going to encourage Israel to start saying, yes, these are people we can negotiate with, or to say, oh, yeah, okay, Hamas can do the right thing. And I think that's one of the reasons why the Palestinians have ended up with a Hamas government, because they've tried the route of collaboration. Fatah was renowned for helping Israel. I mean, even some of its senior figures were involved in selling cement to the Israelis to build a wall. I mean, there's some rather unpleasant and unsavory episodes involving Fatah, which ordinary Palestinians were very aware of. It didn't matter that Fatah was playing Israel's game. Israel still didn't move towards creating any kind of Palestinian state. So I think Palestinians realized that there was no point even in staying with their political leaders who were prepared to collaborate or prepared to go easy on Israel. They decided to play tough, and Hamas was the natural choice for them. Now we're condemning them because they've made that choice, but we're the ones who forced them into making that choice, because we didn't do anything, we didn't encourage them, we didn't give them any prizes or awards for doing what we wanted them to do, or said we wanted them to do. And I'm using we here, rather. But, you know, I think that the international community has to take responsibility for the election of Hamas. Hamas is a sign that the Palestinians are fed up with being lied to, fed up with being mistreated, and that they're no longer prepared to play ball in that kind of way.
That was an interview with British journalist Jonathan Cook, who lives and writes from Nazareth. And finally, how are Palestinians reacting to the inauguration of Donald Trump? We turn to Palestinian journalist Shireen Khalel, based in Ramallah, who writes the following in Mondo Weiss. As Americans gather across the country in a mixture of celebration and protest following the inauguration of U.S. President Donald Trump, Palestinians in the occupied territory are expressing their own concerns of what a Trump presidency will mean for them. As Trump made his inaugural speech in Washington, a handful of youth leaders gathered by the separation wall in the occupied West Bank district of Bethlehem, lighting images of Trump on fire and posting up banners with messages such as, "Move your embassy to your own country, not ours," and "Stop Trump. Jerusalem is the capital of Palestine." Naji Odeh, director of Palestinian Youth Action Center for Community Development, was in attendance, and he told Mondo Weiss that while he does not think Trump will be good for Palestinian politics, he does not see a Trump administration as being drastically better or worse for Palestine than the Obama administration had been or what the Hillary Clinton administration could have been. "I think they are all very similar," Odeh said. "Trump's stance will be in the same political direction. He can't completely change everything the way he says he can. He says the things he says for the media. Yes, Trump will certainly support Israel, but Obama did too." One point Odeh is concerned with is Trump's promise to move the U.S. embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. both Palestinians and Israelis strive to make Jerusalem their own capital, and because of the contentious nature of the city's status, many states, as well as the United Nations, support Jerusalem having an international status and do not recognize the city as the capital of either communities. In 1995, the Jerusalem Embassy Act was passed by the 104th U.S. Congress. The act stated that by 1998, the U.S. Embassy in Israel would be moved to Jerusalem and that the city would be declared an undivided capital of Israel. However, U.S. Presidents Clinton, Bush, and Obama opposed the act as an infringement on the presidential office's authority over foreign policy, consistently overriding the bill. Odeh said he feels confident that Trump will go through on his promise to transfer the embassy to Jerusalem, though he's not sure on the time frame such a move would take place. I think he will succeed in moving the embassy because really, who can say no to him when it comes to that? Even the Palestinian Authority will eventually accept the move, he said. It's so easy for the American president to move an embassy. The Palestinian Authority doesn't need to agree with it, and in the end, the Palestinian Authority receives orders and they don't react. Now, the international community won't support them, but they will say it is an American issue and escape from responsibility. If he does move the embassy, there will be outrage, but the action will come from the people, not governments, and not just in Palestine, he added. On Thursday, Trump reportedly reiterated his stance on the embassy move to the Israel Hayom Hebrew language daily, telling a reporter that, "You know that I'm not a person who breaks promises." Mustafa Barghouti, a member of the Palestinian Parliament and Secretary General of the Palestinian National Initiative, agreed that in general the United States' stance on the Palestinian-Israeli conflict does not change much regardless of who is president, but he is concerned by some of Trump's statements regarding the American embassy being moved to Jerusalem, as well as appointment of David Friedman, an Orthodox Jewish bankruptcy lawyer, who has voiced his support for the annexation and Israeli settlement of the West Bank. There have certainly been signals that have come from the Trump camp that are very alarming, including the threat to move the American embassy to Jerusalem and the talks that came out of his administration about Israel's illegal settlements not being an obstacle to peace, as well as statements about annexing parts of the West Bank to Israel, Barghouti said. And there were certain statements made by Mr. Friedman that are alarming. His appointment itself is alarming. What we hope is that the strong reactions of the international community concerning the embassy move will be enough to convince Mr. Trump not to commit such a major mistake, he said. When asked if he thought some of the statements made by Trump's administration could cause a popular Palestinian uprising on the ground, Barghouti said there is already a threat of another Palestinian uprising without the contention brought to the table by Trump. Israel is fueling sparks for a new intifada through its crimes every day, Barghouti said. The main instigator in a new intifada would certainly be Israel and its behavior, but moving the embassy to Jerusalem will absolutely spark flames, not only here, but worldwide. A move like this is not something small that would be forgotten in a week or so. It's a major political move, and it would mean the U.S. is nullifying its position of being a partner in the peace process. George Abu Eid, 25, and a history and science teacher from the West Bank with a degree in political science, called Trump a racist, bigot, xenophobic narcissist, but told Mondeweiss that, in a way, he's happy a person with Trump's personality has taken control of the American presidency. for Palestinians like myself, who have been following up and observing the U.S. elections, certainly we were not looking for any hope in our situation out of either outcome. Both Hillary and Trump are actually not that different as far as greater evil in regards to Palestine and the world goes, he said. However, from my humble perspective, I believe that Trump as a U.S. president is much better than Hillary because somehow Trump reflects the true colors of the American society, a white supremacist racist society that has been living in denial and ignorance for a long time. To be honest, we Palestinians have plenty of experience dealing with a man like Trump over someone like Hillary, he added, since we have been doing so with Mr. Netanyahu for the past decade. In other words, we now can look at reality and expect the worst instead of deluding ourselves with hopes for a bright future. Laura Hamden, a Palestinian-American student from St. Louis who just returned to the U.S. from winter break in the occupied West Bank, said that if Trump keeps his promises regarding the embassy, essentially recognizing Jerusalem as the capital of Israel, it will signal loss of hope. Recognizing Jerusalem as the only capital of Israel is sort of telling the Palestinian side that you really have no future in deciding your own autonomy, she said. While Hamden is concerned about the implication of what a Trump presidency will mean for Palestine, she also has a more immediate concern about the safety of her Muslim family in America. It's no surprise what Trump's stance on Israel is, considering most presidents before him have the same point of view. So my family saw it coming, Hamden said. But what my family is mainly concerned about is what might happen domestically. They all said Trump supporters are more dangerous than Trump himself. My mom wears the hijab and notices more people look at her critically now. My brother, who never concerns himself with politics really, told me, I'm afraid for mom, for you, for anybody that looks any way different or foreign. That was an article from Mondo Weiss, written by Palestinian journalist Shireen Khalil. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You'll find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at WZBC.org. Thanks for listening, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday and every Sunday. You are tuned to WZBC 90.3 FM, Newton, Massachusetts. And this is John Roberts wishing you a good morning.